This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hi, my name's Stephen Scott. I'm Chair of the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the first of our In Conversation series. These are going out live and also recorded webinars and podcast discussions with the leading players in child and young people's mental health. It gives me enormous pleasure to introduce Sir Robin Murray, Fellow of the Royal Society, who has spent a lifetime researching what leads up to psychoses and what can be done about them. He has illuminated this field across several different aspects, which I hope to draw out, Robin, today. Welcome. And I guess I'd like to ask you, what got you interested in psychoses?
Well, before I answer that, I say that you're kicking off this inaugural series with experts in child psychiatry, but I'm not an expert in child psychiatry. So I'm an adult psychiatrist specialising in psychosis, but of course, I think now we see more psychosis in young people, so I myself get more involved in the care or an assessment of younger people with psychosis. So how did I get involved with psychosis? When I was a medical student in Glasgow, I discovered that there was a deal that you could get free board and lodging in one of the local mental hospitals. They were called asylums then. It was called Leverendale. And medical students were employed to do physical examinations. So the Scottish law was that people who were chronically in psychiatric hospitals, every year they needed to have a physical examination. So I became one of four medical students who did that, and we were looked after so well. I guess the catering department had a limited budget for all the patients, and they liked sometimes to cook a little bit extra. So the medical students were the beneficiaries of this. But as part of that, there was always psychotic people wandering around the grounds, and always you could always talk to them, and so I got to know quite a lot of what would be called chronic psychotic people at that time, and of course it's fascinating to talk to such people.
It is, wow. And so you carried on in this field, yes?
Yeah, well, I got deviated into renal disease for three or four years, but eventually came back to my first love, which was psychiatry, and came to London, and then got most interested in psychosis.
And what were the prevailing theories of the cause of psychosis, and indeed the treatments, then?
Well, the world was split into two diametrically opposed groups. There were the hardline biologists who thought after Kraepelin that schizophrenia was genetic disorder, that it was a brain disorder, and it was a deteriorating disorder. So there was that group. Elliot Slater was the great proponent of that view. He was a very famous geneticist who worked here at that time. And one of my colleagues said he was very interested in the history of the patient right up to the time of birth. After that, he was interested in things like genetics and the mother's pregnancy and labour and things like that. So it was that sort of group, hardline biologists. And at the other extreme, there were psychoanalytically oriented people who didn't believe there was any genetic component, didn't believe there was any biological component, and thought that many of the problems originated from bad parenting. Or, for example, the refrigerator mother who was cold in relation to her child, or interpersonal difficulties, marital schism and skew, they called it. They did studies showing that the parents of people with schizophrenia were rather strange and odd. and published this, but what they never did was to study the parents of normal children. They discovered, when they did this, discovered the rest of parents like us, we were just as strange and odd as the parents of people with schizophrenia. Yes.
And so when I was, first of all, a psychology student, there was quite a lot of almost cult following of a fellow Scottish psychiatrist, Ardie Lang, who had a theory, I think, that schizophrenia was a sort of flight from reality into a journey of experience. And it seemed to me at the time there were quite a lot of adherents of these beliefs.
Yes, well, because Ronnie Lang came from Glasgow, when I was actually in Glasgow, I read all his books, and I was in a different mental hospital where he had worked called Gartnable, and I was determined to find some notes written by the great prophet R.D. Lang. I thought this might be some great new insight into a psychotic patient's thinking, and I looked through all the old notes of people, some of them dead and so on. Eventually I found a note which said, 2 a.m. called to ward, this elderly lady has fallen and fractured her femur, R.D. Lang. And that was the only thing I ever found.
No wonderful but interpretations.
At that time of the morning, I guess that was enough. So I certainly, Ronnie Lang was a huge figure, not just in psychiatry, but this was the time of the Vietnam War. He was leading protests. He was meeting with the Beatles. He was a sort of general guru of wise words, and he was also a poet. And he read his poetry with a very strong Glasgow accent, and it was a bit difficult to understand anybody. But for people who were from outside Glasgow, it was incomprehensible. And therefore, they thought it must be brilliant. Ronnie Lang was a huge figure, really, on the idea that psychosis was understandable, and even that psychosis was a normal reaction to a mad world, and that people should be allowed to express themselves. On the other hand, Lang said, so some ways we think these are ideas are ridiculous, but on the other hand, he said people with psychosis are much more understandable than most psychiatrists believe. Most psychiatrists believe this is a brain disease, it's like Alzheimer's, it's not much point wondering what the voices are about, but Ronnie Lang said you can understand people. And of course, this is what psychologists, the basis of CBT, that you can understand the development of the delusions. And of course, he also said that psychiatry is often a coercive force as an agent of the state. And sadly, I think that still is the case for people like us who practice in the inner city where people have appalling conditions. And really, we ought to address the conditions they live in, but instead we patch them up by taking them into hospital.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. So Robin, as a young researcher, you've got the brain and genetics people on one side and the psychosocial experience one on the others. How did you go about tackling these? What research strategies did you deploy? What did you end up doing?
The sad thing, of course, was that those of an analytical bent or social analytical bent didn't do any research. It was thought to be too difficult. Of course, now they do. I worked for a while with Jim Burley, who very famous for having looked at the effect of life events and showed that people with psychosis often broke down following life events. But at that time, we tended to think this was just a trigger. We didn't think it was necessarily a real cause. So there wasn't much opportunity to do research in the psychosocial field. And at that time, North American psychiatry had been totally analytical, that every chairman of every department in North America was a psychoanalyst. And it just began to change in the 1970s. So I went to the States for a year to learn a bit about neuroscience and neurotransmitters. And then I came back, and by accident, the gentleman, Jerry Shields, who ran our twin register here, he died quite young. And he was a very shy man, and not many people went to his funeral. So I went to his funeral together with the then professor of psychiatry. And on the way back, he said to me, we're going to have to shut down this twin register, this twin unit, because there's nobody who could run it. I said, well, not yet, please. I could run it, even though I knew nothing about genetics. But so that got me started by accident into studying twins and then into other biological studies. But one of the first studies we did was taking identical twins where one had schizophrenia and one was well, and we were able to show that the one with schizophrenia had bigger cerebral ventricles and decreased cortical volume compared with the person with their co-twin who didn't have schizophrenia.
Okay, so this wasn't comparing monozygotic identical twins versus non-identical. This is within identical
ones. Yes, people who had identical genes.
Yeah. So this is kind of interesting because that almost suggests, well, genes are not all the story then.
Oh, yes, and of course we know that only 50% of cases where you have one person who has schizophrenia or psychosis, the second twin, 50% or more cases will be entirely well.
And their offspring? The well one's offspring?
Well, they seem to still have an increased risk. So it's as if you're transmitting the genetic vulnerability, but then adverse things have to happen to you to light up this vulnerability.
Yes. And on the genetic front, how early now do we think in those who are going to develop schizophrenia there is an abnormality in brain development? Or?
Well, it varies. And what we do know is that there are a small proportion of people who develop psychosis who have quite a major genetic defect called a copy number variation, where they actually lose a chunk of their DNA, and it may knock out 4 or 5 genes or up, 15 genes. And if these genes are involved in neurodevelopment, then naturally they're going to have difficulties from early on in life. That probably accounts for about 3% of people with schizophrenia.
Okay,
as I understand, it's maybe 15% of people with autism.
Yeah.
So these folk we would think of as having a developmental schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Maybe about a third of people who develop schizophrenia will have had difficulties in childhood, not just being a little bit slower to walk or to talk, a few months slower, not doing quite so well at school as their brothers and sisters, IQ maybe being 5 points below brothers and sisters. Nothing really to get dramatically worried about, and you can't obviously take all of these folk and say you're at risk of developing schizophrenia, but it's just an indicator that for some people they've had some developmental brain problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. And on the other hand, I know you have led studies which have shown really quite a lot of variation, for example within Europe, in the incidence of psychosis. Is that the case?
Yes, I haven't led these studies, I've been involved in them. Jim Van Os in particular from Holland has led them, but we've looked at 16 different sites across Europe, and there are few things that the British lead on any longer, but sadly we lead on the incidence of psychosis. So the incidence of psychosis in a paper just published Hannah Jongsma et al. In JAMA Psychiatry, it showed that the incidence of psychosis is 10 times higher in South London than it is in parts of Spain and southern Italy. So it's a dramatic difference.
Wow, that is a huge difference. It's not 30% or 40%, 10 times.
Yes.
1,000%. I mean, that is gobsmacking, isn't it? Yes.
It certainly surprised us. Now, we trained everybody that you had to get every person who developed psychosis from your area, and you had to use the same diagnostic instruments and so on. So I think people used the same criteria. Now, maybe the people in Spain or Italy, maybe they missed a few cases. They didn't miss 9 out of 10 cases. So undoubtedly there is a big difference. And we know some of the causes, and I think we know that migration increases the risk of psychosis, yes. And we know that London and the other places with high incidence were Amsterdam and Paris. that they've had lots of migrants coming for many, many years. And we know that when you move from one country to another, you're more prone to paranoia and to developing a psychosis. So when you take away migrants and their children, the difference diminishes maybe about a third. So there are obviously still other factors. Okay.
But that is still interesting, Robin, because some people have had a theory that the people who've got the gump to get up and go and migrate are the more intelligent, mentally healthier, and not the left behind us. So it is still interesting, isn't it? It must be illuminative what is their experience.
Yes, I think you're correct that by and large, migrants are often more able. Now, you can't say that migrants from Syria are moving for the same reasons as migrants from Finland, but in general, I think what you say is correct. But I guess think of the experience of somebody from Syria at present, that they've been bombed and their friends and their relatives slaughtered. They somehow escape over the treacherous mountains. They get to Turkey, where they're exploited and their money stolen. They then get put in a boat that maybe sinks and they have to go back and then try again. So these people are really traumatised.
Yes. So, is there better evidence phenomenologically that it is anxiety and trauma that predisposes to the onset of psychosis?
So we do know that we can think that what about child trauma, which of course many people watching listening will be very familiar with, that until maybe 10 years ago it was not thought that child abuse was associated with psychosis. But we now know that child abuse is bad for all psychiatric disorders, practically, and psychosis is no exception. So the usual things, physical sexual abuse, childhood neglect, all increase the risk. But so too do bullying and adverse life events, particularly of a victimisation type. So for an adult psychiatrist, if your boyfriend dumps you, or your girlfriend dies, or you suffer a loss, you're more likely to develop depression. But yes, if you're assaulted in the street, or you're burgled, or have some intrusive life event, then this seems to be more associated with psychosis.
And I think in the last 20 or 30 years, there has been a coming together of psychosocial and brain explanations, because at one level, every event has to be interpreted by the brain. Are we any further in understanding how these psychosocial events might affect the brain, or are they completely out with neurotransmitter explanations?
Well, I think there has been a biological explanation for a long time that you might inherit genes which might make you more prone to developmental problems or to dopaminergic abnormalities. And psychosis is associated with when you're acutely psychotic and things around seem very strange and you're hearing voices and you think people may be out to harm you. That's associated with an excess synthesis and release of dopamine in the striatum. And that's very clear. And it subsides as you get better. But so there was this biological theory, genes to dopamine, that could be understood. And then there was a sort of social theory, which we didn't know how it fitted at all. But now there's increasing evidence that social adversity or social stress, child abuse, migration, they all impact on the dopamine system.
That is fascinating, isn't it?
Yes. So there's a very nice, it's a nasty test called the Montreal Stress Test, where they take a group of people and they say, we're all going to do a arithmetic, and you'll be in a PET scanner, and at the end of the, we'll finish the experiment, we'll put a board up on how everybody did, who was best and who was worst, and then they make it just too difficult for you to manage. If you manage to do it right, they increase the difficulty. And then as you're doing it, even when you get it right, they say, wrong. and you say, you know, 4 times 20, I thought I was right. But by that time, you're on to the next one. And you get more and more anxious. And then a voice says, you're doing very badly. You're the worst in your group. You, can't you try harder? It's a very expensive test. And of course, people get very, very stressed. And when you do that to ordinary folk, then you see a release of dopamine in the striatum. But people in what we call the prodrome, or the who have the at-risk mental state for psychosis, who are teetering on the brink of developing psychosis, they release more dopamine. So they are more, their dopamine system is more vulnerable to stress.
Yes.
People who are already psychotic, they show even an even greater response to the
wow.
stress. So now we know acute stress causes this. We know that if you take young people, if you take young men, split them into those who've been abused as a child and those who haven't been abused as a child, the ones who have been abused as a child, they release more dopamine as well.
Golly.
And migrants too, surprisingly. Just one study for migrants, but maybe when you're more insecure and you're stressed, if you're a migrant, you maybe don't feel quite so comfortable. So a whole range of social factors are now shown to impact on the dopamine system, which we know impacts on your likelihood of going psychotic.
Yes. This is so interesting because, of course, there's increased interest now in adverse childhood experiences and the mechanisms through which they may work, including inflammatory, but and the dopamine as well.
Yes, also other theories. The problem when I started psychiatry for psychosis, there was just two theories which we discussed, and they really were, we didn't have any known causes for psychosis. Now we've got almost too many causes, lots of genes, and a whole range of social adversities.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, what I'd like to take you on, which I know will be of interest to adolescent mental health workers, is the whole role of drugs, Robin, and the extent to which they can be important in psychosis. On the one hand, as a father of children who've just left teenage, I know there's an awful lot of drugs out there. They are seen by young people as fairly harmless. We have David Nutt, who said that cannabis is safer than horse riding. That may be using death as the end point, I think. Could you tell us about your own studies and where we're at on that whole issue?
Just correct you. David said that ecstasy was ecstasy was more safer than horse riding. And actually, he was on the radio when a gentleman phoned up and said, "Hey, Dr. Professor Nutt, my daughter is about to be 14. I've been thinking of buying her a pony. Should I buy her 5-year supply of ecstasy instead?" I don't remember his reply, but ecstasy itself actually is not associated with an increased risk of psychosis, but it's the drugs that have especially an effect on dopamine, which is cocaine, amphetamine, and methamphetamine across the Pacific in Australia and South Africa. South Africa, in some places, a third of all the people with psychosis are methamphetamine psychotic.
Wow. What are the street names of methamphetamine?
Actually, I don't know the street names because I've only seen one person.
I need to know what to tell people to avoid tonight.
Yes. excuse me, crystal meths would be. I'm forgetting, so far we've been lucky. We haven't had much methamphetamine. CAT, which is a drug which is used in the Horn of Africa where people chew leaves,
yes,
it can
yes.
induce psychosis, but particularly cannabis. And when I was young, psychiatrists didn't bother about cannabis. It didn't seem to be very important. But from the 1990s, we started seeing more psychotic people who were using cannabis. At first, we used to ignore it. But then, gradually, as the relatives kept telling us, you need to pay attention to this, we started. And so we know that cannabis, old-fashioned cannabis, has a modest effect on increasing risk of psychosis. But what we would call high-potency cannabis is maybe about four or five times stronger than old
is
fashioned.
Is this skunk?
And in the UK, it would be called skunk. In Holland, it would be called a nederweed. And so, different places are a whole range of different names in different countries. And we know that these high potency types are much more risky. So around here, in South London, your risk of psychosis is about five times higher if you use high potency skunk every day. And so around here, about 25% of all cases of psychosis are due to the use of high potency cannabis. Across Europe, I can tell you that in Holland, over 50% are due to high potency, to cannabis. In Holland, it's mostly high potency. Whereas if you go to somewhere like Bologna or Palermo, less than 5%, because they don't use so much cannabis, and what they use is much less potent.
Yes. So in my day, we used to see people in the emergency clinic, and within a week, they were better. But what I'm hearing is it can lead to irreversible.
Yes, you still see people who go acutely psychotic. I gave a lecture, and afterwards the chairman, who was a psychiatrist, said, I didn't like to say publicly, but I went psychotic once. I had a very nice girlfriend who was a great cook, and she made a cake for my birthday, and I ate a lot, and she was getting more and more alarmed. Then I went psychotic, he said. She'd put cannabis in the cake. So a chap like that, we'll just have an acute psychosis, and a few days later we'll be all right. So people who just go acutely psychotic, if they've taken a really big dose, if they've not been chronic users, they can certainly recover quickly.
But chronic users can be led into schizophrenia.
Yes. So cannabis use is a component cause, what we call a component cause. There are no single cause, but genetic vulnerability, obstetric insult, childhood adversity, being a migrant, using cannabis, all of these are risk factors that add up to push you over the threshold into psychosis.
And now, is it true that it's just the same thing that's stronger, or is some of the balance of the components of modern street cannabis?
Reading this up. Or maybe your children have been telling you. So the psychotogenic substance in cannabis is tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, and we can take normal volunteers, lots of people volunteer for this, and give them intravenous THC. Yes. And so they get a bit of a high, but a proportion get paranoid and suspicious and even have a brief psychosis. But cannabidiol, or CBD, is the other biggest component of the cannabis plant. And if you actually give people CBD and then give them intravenous THC, they don't go psychotic. They maybe get a bit anxious, but you can ameliorate this. Now, if you think of hashish or old-fashioned resin, it would have 3 or 4% THC and 3 or 4% CBD. Skunk would have about 16% THC and just detectable CBD. Nederweed might have 60% THC and no CBD. So you get a greater bang from the THC, and you don't have the ameliorating effect of the CBD in the more modern types.
Is this because drug sellers have preferred to have a stronger one, and incidentally it's...
Yes, I think, but also why do heavy alcohol users prefer spirits? You tend to get tolerant, and therefore you want something stronger. Of course, also it's easier. You can charge more, and it's of course the question of portability. So there is an escalating race to increased potency of cannabis, but there are of course now synthetic cannabinoids, sometimes called spice, or K2. And THC is a partial agonist at the receptor, so it binds loosely to the CB1 receptor, the cannabinoid receptor. things like spice, they are 100% agonists. So they hit the receptor in a much more strong way. Right. And therefore, you're like 30 times more likely to end up in an A and E unit if you take spice than if you take old-fashioned cannabis.
Wow. There's a huge difference, isn't there? Well, that's absolutely fascinating, Robin. Last sentence, what is the future likely to bring, do you think? One can't gaze into a crystal ball, but what are the hot research growing points for the future, do you think?
The sad thing about all we've been talking about is that it hasn't had a huge effect on treatment yet. But I think as we understand the biology, I think we'll be, and excuse me, not just the biology, and the social science, we'll be able to split up psychosis into different types. I think very biological types, and then types secondary to social adversity, and we'll have different neurochemical types, and therefore different drugs to treat different types. At present, everybody gets a mixture of antipsychotics, and if they're lucky, cognitive behaviour therapy. Yes. But it's a one-for-all treatment at present. In the future, I think, I don't think this term schizophrenia will exist. It will break up into different subtypes.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Robin. That is fascinating, and I want to tell people who are watching this that they can come and see you in person on Friday the 16th of March at the Emmanuel Miller Memorial Lecture, put on by ACAM, which, as well as Robin, will have sessions on depression, self-harm, and school-based interventions to reduce bullying and some of those factors, as well as the currently very prominent issue of gender identity. Robin, would you be prepared to answer one or two questions that have come in?
Yes.
Thank you. So, question one, is it possible that in the case of identical twins, the subjective experiences of the twins as individuals would impact the rate of expression and development of schizophrenia in healthy and unhealthy parents?
It's 30 years ago, this was a very lively issue. And I think it's clearly the case that if you are an identical twin, that you're much closer to your sibling than you would be if you were just brothers. The crucial studies, I think, well, they may not answer the questioner correctly. There have been studies of identical twins reared apart. So, by mischance, some twins are separated and brought up in one house and in another house, but they still have the same risk of psychosis. But of course, they're not with each other all the time. Mm-hmm. So, I've seen enough. We used to collect twins, so I've seen enough cases where one twin goes psychotic and the second one is distraught by this, and the stress, I'm sure, does contribute to their onset of psychosis, but it is psychosis that they develop rather than anxiety or depression. Yes. But I should say, we used to think that the evidence for a genetic contribution came from twin and adoption studies. Yeah. Well, it does, but the big evidence comes from molecular genetic studies.
Yes.
There's now a study of 66,000 people who had a diagnosis of schizophrenia versus 120,000 people who were normal controls. And there are about 200 points on the genome where they differ, which means there's at least 100 little genes for schizophrenia. It's not you get a big gene and you're going to go psychotic. It's like the genes that make some of us taller or some of us shorter or some of us fatter. So there are genes that will contribute to your vulnerability. So we used to think 90%, 99% of the population had no genes for schizophrenia and one had a big gene that made you schizophrenia. Now we know they're distributed through the population. And we also know that psychosis is distributed through the population. That 10% of normal people have a psychotic symptoms. They are totally paranoid about their neighbour, or they think they can hear, they hear a voice calling them. Now we just have to accept that that's just normal, and why should psychiatrists interfere?
Yeah, fascinating. So it's not just a discrete thing. Another question is, what are your views about accepting drug-induced cases of psychosis into an early intervention psychosis service, which sees people up for 3 years? Do they need an early intervention psychosis service, or actually drug services to reduce the habit, or both?
Well, they have psychosis, so they need treatment from psychosis. You have a myocardial infarction, you have a heart attack. You don't get stopped at the door of the coronary unit to say, is this induced by cigarettes or not? So I think they develop a psychosis. They do need to have a specialised input. The traditional treatment for people with drug-induced psychosis in Britain is, your drug use has caused you to develop psychosis. No, I don't think this is right. Well, if you don't stop, you have to stop taking a cannabis. I don't know if I can do that. Well, there's nothing we can do for you. So I think we need to have a much more sophisticated approach. Sadly, in the UK, drug units are competent therapists for people with drug problems are few and far between. So really, we have thought that we have to develop this ourselves. It's the same with any type of... It's difficult to give up smoking. It's difficult to lose weight. It's difficult to stop drinking. So you can't... And if you're psychotic, it's more difficult. So we have to be patient. And of course, it's unlikely that an 18-year-old will stop smoking cannabis because an aging Scottish Calvinist tells them to do it. But if other people who've been through it, who've developed psychosis, and there are quite a lot of people who are willing to do this and be sort of advocates and help people to get through the difficulties. Well, of course, all their friends are taking cannabis as well.
It's a hard one, isn't it? Right, my last question, Robin, has come in, is can CBT be used clinically by professionals and psychiatrists as an antipsychotic?
Yes, I think CBT is very important. I chaired a thing called the Schizophrenia Commission in Britain, and we said every patient deserves to have the opportunity to have pharmacological treatment, and they deserve to have the opportunity to have a psychological treatment. And the one which there is most evidence for is CBT. There are lots of studies of CBT and meta-analyses, and some of them say it has a big effect, and some of them say it has a very modest effect. It's more difficult to prove, of course. If it's a drug, it's a drug. You know, a medicine is the same everywhere, but you get good CBT therapists and you get duff ones. We've been very lucky to have very good CBT therapists, and I've seen people transformed. Wow. By being given an understanding of the sort of explanations as to why they misinterpreted the world in this way. So CBT is very important, I think.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Robin. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've learnt a lot. I hope our viewers have learnt a lot. And this is part of a whole range of ACAM free resources, including blogs, articles, recorded lectures, topic guides. So visit our website at www.acamh.org and look at social media, ACAM, for latest news. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org. And follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.